Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Markless Center for Applied Ethics Program. My name is David DeCoste, Director of Campus Ethics Programs at the Ethics Center. It is my pleasure to introduce Lisa Krieger, the science and medical research reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Lisa Krieger covers news from Stanford University, the University of California, and other Bay Area research facilities. Her recent acclaimed and prize-winning series, The Cost of Dying, a chronicle of her father's final days, was circulated to hundreds of thousands of Bay Area households. She has also covered public health problems in other places throughout the world. Prior to joining the Mercury News in 1998, Ms. Krieger was the medical writer for the San Francisco Examiner, where for 12 years she wrote about the AIDS epidemic and other public health issues. An award-winning journalist in many different capacities and former National Association of Science Writers Fellow at Duke University School of Medicine, Ms. Krieger co-authored the book Incredible Voyage, Exploring the Human Body, published by the National Geographic Press. She has also edited the University of California Press book on AIDS, A Community Response. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Krieger.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about my own story, what I learned from my experience, and how it shaped how I think about death, how I think about end-of-life care, and I'm sure many of you have your own experiences and expertise that I'd be happy to hear about. How we die matters. You know, it matters to us, of course, but it matters even more to the survivors, the people who experience our deaths, the people who will remember that experience of our dying long after we're gone. It's something that carries forward through our tale, our family narrative. It's what our kids and our grandchildren remember. And the experience can be very moving and very memorable. You're able to say, I love you, thank you for being who you were. Or it can be an experience filled in an ICU unit with tubes and different types of interventions that make those conversations so hard to have. So I'll start with describing my dad's story a bit. He was a child of the Depression. His story started 90 years ago in Louisville, Kentucky, and he was the son of a judge, but they saved enough money to get him to engineering school, and then World War II broke out. So he was sent to Columbia University to work on the Manhattan Project. He was a very smart man. And it really shaped who he was. He then went to Oak Ridge and later in life became a very successful engineer. He got an MBA and traveled the world troubleshooting different manufacturing plants. He was a great dad. I was an only child, very much a father's daughter. He tutored me long distance through calculus and organic chemistry, if you can imagine. We skied together. We played tennis together. I was very, very close to him. But at age 88, there wasn't a whole lot left. You know, he had really progressed Alzheimer's disease. We had lost my mom suddenly, but he couldn't remember what had happened to her. So every day would essentially start with, where's your mom? I can't find her. Please help me find her. What happened to her? We'd recount her death, and then the day would deteriorate from there. He wasn't sure who he was. He wasn't sure why he was here in California with me. He was depressed and also was very uncomfortable, had back problems, knee problems, would spend a lot of time just sleeping and then agitated. But the crazy thing was I kept thinking he'd go on, you know? I just never anticipated that moment when there'd be a crisis, and I was not prepared. And I really thought that love enough would keep him going. And tragically, a day lot like today, he developed a very minor skin infection. Within 12 hours, became a full-blown galloping case of sepsis, traveled up his leg. I rushed him to the emergency room. He was in a memory care unit at that point at an assisted living facility, rushed him to the emergency room. thinking that was the right thing to do and thinking that those were the experts who could help fix him. And what I discovered upon getting there is that the ER is very much of a freeway to ICU. And once you're there, and you know, I love modern medicine. Modern medicine has given us miracles, and it can be so helpful when it's appropriate. But there weren't a whole lot of exit ramps once we got there. So they asked him, do you have a do not resuscitate order? I stupidly thought that was enough, and then it was all systems go. So in the ICU, basically what became a small infection became a massive blood infection. His immune system was shot, so they gave him immunoglobulins at a cost of $48,000 each from Pfizer. I've talked to them about that, and it's a very wonderful medication, totally inappropriate for an 88-year-old with advanced dementia and no real will to live. We received state-of-the-art antibiotics to try and turn this thing around. That they start at $2,000 to $3,000 an injection. This is the bill to Medicare, which, you know, we all pay, of course. A day in the ICU, do you know what the daily charge is for just one day, just to rent the room of ICU, not including anything else? $25,000 each day. He was there for 10 days before we lost him. The final bill was to Medicare was $323,000 for 10 days of care. During this process, they did what doctors do. You know, they wanted to save his life. So they proposed surgery, of course, on his leg. Then that they suggested amputation because the infection was in the bone. They suggested skin grafts, of course, because of the amputation. 4 to 6 months skilled nursing care would have been required because of that. And this is in a person who I love dearly but would never really get out of it. So that experience taught me a lot. It taught me about what medicine can offer, but also how hard it is to say no. It's really, really hard to say no. There's so much available. We're so caught up in our own success of what medicine can do. And it's forced us to make a lot of decisions that we're really not prepared for at all. And I guess in writing about this, my call to action is for us to start thinking about some of these decisions. And so many of the tools are so useful, but when are they really over the top? When do they prolong dying instead of prolonging life? And something that I think we really need to explore as a society. I also wanted to draw attention to the huge collateral damage that's caused by really well-intentioned interventions. So my piece described my father's death, and then I talked a little bit about what is a good death and how do we get there. And a lot of stories were written about some of the choices and decisions that we're faced with. And I had several installments. One of them, and readers were wonderful in sharing their experiences. I've probably heard from hundreds and hundreds of people, many of whom had stories far worse than mine, many of whom described some of their own conundrums. There was a wonderful man named Ray Brown out in Martinez whose mother was in her 90s, who underwent three surgeries at the end of her life, and he talked about how love can cloud your thinking. Wonderful woman named Cheryl Gordon, whose husband needed a drug, $400 a day. She was his sole caregiver. She would, you know, rush to get the medication, rush to bring it back to keep his heart going, recognizing that, again, she was just prolonging his dying and not prolonging his life. I talked a lot about advance directives and the importance of advance directives, and anyone who has not done one, really recommend it. There are communities where As a community, they've decided this is really important, and that when you go in for your annual physical at age 40 or age 50, to really start the conversation with your doctor as to what sort of intervention do or don't you want. There are times in life when heroic intervention is totally appropriate. There are times it's not. So I did a piece about advance directives and interviewed a wonderful woman, Colleen Huggin, who, when her best friend was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, they went out to McWhorter's. First they got a manicure, and then they manicures together, and then they went to McWhorter's and filled out the advance directive, where essentially designating who the responsible party would be to work with the doctors as she deteriorated, and describing how much intervention she would want for cancer at the end of life. A wonderful man named Malcolm Plant, who has three generations of dementia in his family. His grandmother wrote a beautiful letter to her son saying, if I develop dementia, this is when enough is enough. And then the father wrote the same letter to his family, knowing he was at elevated risk, and tragically he developed the disease as well. And now Malcolm has written the same letter to his family. And such a loving gesture. I mean, it's something, it sounds depressing, but it's not. It's what it's saying to your family is, I love you so much that I want to spare you the stress. I want to spare you the indecision. Let me help you through this. And that's what these directives do. I wrote a little bit about palliative care. There's Palo Alto Medical Foundation, and Kaiser's very good at this too, of bringing palliative care, which is wonderful symptom control, pain relief, into the home. And I went and visited a woman in a trailer park down in Aptos. She was 52 years old, Marilyn Cronin. She had advanced liver disease and emphysema and heart problems. And even at age 52, there wasn't a whole lot of hope left. But there was compassion and there was caring, which is really the most any of us can ask for. So I was able to spend time with her as the nurses came to make her comfortable. I wrote about the use of feeding tubes, which I tragically found is way overutilized, particularly in dementia. Feeding tubes can be a wonderful, wonderful device if you've had esophageal cancer, and there's a really good chance of prolonging your life. Roger Ebert, the film critic, had one, and with great success. But for the vast majority of us, they make no sense. And when my dad was in the hospital, they basically wheeled one in and said, it's time for the feeding tube now. And it was really hard to say no, because feeding is so central to who we are and how we care for our loved ones. You don't want to create the perception of, quote unquote, starving someone to death. But the reality of a feeding tube is it really locks you into a clinical situation that where you may not want to stay. You know, with advanced dementia, not eating is pretty normal at the end. And if you can't remember to bring a spoon, you know, certainly helping someone bring a fork or spoon to their mouth is appropriate. But if they can't remember how to swallow, maybe it's time to let go. Start thinking about letting go. I heard from many readers who regretted the decision to use a feeding tube for their loved ones. Because once it's there, you just keep on going. And it takes, you know, while everything else deteriorates, right? And it takes a real act of will at that point to withdraw the feeding tube. Because then it really does feel like you're depriving someone of something. And it's really hard to get family consensus on that. And these issues divide families. And again, these are the conflicts that can live on. I talked wrote a little bit about how care differs from institution to institution. There's a wonderful database called the Dartmouth Atlas that looks at geographic differences and even within one city, differences between hospitals in how aggressive end-of-life care is. Even within, I focused on the city of San Jose, and within a 15-mile radius, Medicare spends $23,000 more per day on a typical patient than in a hospital right down the road. And why is that? And it was really interesting to explore how medical practice varies, how the culture of a hospital varies, and even within, and then, you know, certainly within the U.S. and in geographic areas, it varies. Here in the Bay Area, we are essentially twice as aggressive, spend twice as much money as Portland, another really progressive city. So why is that? And it was just fascinating to look into that. I wrapped up with a piece about hospice, just because I think it's a really underutilized resource. People are increasingly using hospice, but they're also increasingly using the intensive care unit. And what we've found through some wonderful studies published in the New England Journal and JAMA is that hospice is increasingly tacked on to the end of an intensive care experience, that when everything else is no longer working, you rush out to hospice. That really fails to give hospice the full opportunity it deserves to offer the real quality end-of-life experience that it can. So we had the privilege of spending 3 months with a woman who was in hospice. She totally opened her life up to us. And she had a bucket list of things she wanted to accomplish. She had decided she did not want dialysis and did have a whole bunch of things she wanted to do. And so we went to the zoo, we went to the beach, we went camping, pretty rich 3 months. And she was able to reach everyone who had ever meant anything to her in her life and say, thank you, thank you. And it gave them the time to make travel plans and come out and see her. And, you know, it was a pretty peaceful end. And she was so generous because she knew she'd never survive to see the video we did of her and the piece we did of her. But she felt so strongly that hospice was important that she wanted to do that as a real final act. Very brave. And I concluded by describing what I thought would be better ways to change the end-of-life experience here. Some of them we've discussed, and there are others we can explore. And for me, you know, just to wrap up, it was very healing. You know, my dad, all he ever wanted was for me to do the very best I could. It was all he ever asked for. And I felt like I dropped the ball a little bit at his end because I wasn't prepared, but I felt like I was able to redeem that experience by helping others and speaking to groups like you and others. And I guess my message to all of you is to take some of what we talk about today and integrate it into your life, into your family, and move forward so that we can make dying a much more compassionate, better end than it currently is in America. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa, for sharing your insights and personal experiences with us. We have a number of questions from the audience and students. I'll just get things started. I think we have them on the board there, although I can't see them all completely. So it could help if people do have some things you could put on your index cards. That would be helpful if you could send them up also, please. I think wouldn't have any disagreement people saying that the fear of death is about as human a thing as you could encounter. But are we at a stage now where we have sort of an inordinate fear of death? And what did you find in terms of that and how we might address an issue like that?
Very, very good question. Probably a century ago, we were all on the family farm. Animals were born. Animals died. Grandparents probably died on the living room couch, you know, surrounded by family. But we don't die like that anymore. And I think we've really, by handing over death to hospitals, we have made it frightening. And we have removed ourselves from the daily experience of dying. We don't die like we used to, either in, you know, Little Nell or Orphelia or on a farm where maybe you're kicked in the head by a horse or fell off a tractor or died of infectious disease or childbirth. God forbid. Death happened pretty quickly, and it happened while we were watching it. So I think we are afraid of it. There's sort of an increasing movement to create a natural death, much as we now have a natural birth, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Because death, you know, none of us are going to get out of the 21st century alive. You know, like it or not, we actually, you know, death... That's going to happen. And what I learned is that we can make it better or worse. And not to let fear deprive us of what's a really rich experience, right? I mean, what do we ultimately all really care about, right? We want to make a difference. We want to know that we're loved. We want to know that our memory will carry forward. That's what it's all about. And if you're robbed of that chance to have that conversation and that reflection and that bonding, it's a loss for everybody. So not to let fear blind us and rob us of that chance.
Many audience members raise questions about DNRs, and I'll add to that sort of advanced directives, things of that nature.
Right.
And a number of the questions were, in a sense, practical. What could work to facilitate greater use of these, much broader use? What in your reporting, Lisa, did you find or come across in terms of a question like that?
Thank you. Very underutilized. California Healthcare Foundation did a beautiful survey, and they found that 80% of us really have pretty specific wishes about end-of-life care. Only 20% of us have actually communicated those wishes to the people who matter. 20% of us. So I'll steer free of jargon, but advanced directives are actually really simple. And they seem really scary and they seem really intimidating, and they're not. You could do it on the back of a cocktail napkin. Just three major components. One is you need to designate someone who's going to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself. You might want to fall back, an alternate, if that person's away. You need to specify what sort of, you know, what level of intervention you would prefer at the end. There's no wrong answer, right? Maybe life's worth living no matter what, and that's totally fine. And that's your chance to say that there. Or you could say, if I'm in a place where I'm no longer conscious, I'm no longer able to recognize the people that matter to me, let's call it a day. And then there's also a chance there to be as creative as you want. You know, people have, you know, they can write long, eloquent letters about to guide those around, to help them, help guide those who will be there at their bedside. And the third part is to get two witnesses. Pretty simple. These witnesses don't have to agree with what you wrote. They don't even have to read necessarily what you wrote. They just need to say you are who you say you are and sign it. That's a real document. That's a document you can take with you to the ER and show it to the attending physician. And it's also, I guess, the other really important point to make is it's not just about the document. It's about the conversation. And what's wonderful about these documents is they really create a launching point to have the conversation with your loved ones. The reality is a lot of things that happen in hospitals may not be precisely, you know, as you would have had them play out in your advance directive. But the conversation is really important because when push comes to shove and family members are trying to decide whether to proceed or not, that conversation is what they'll remember. I've had the privilege of talking to a lot of different people about how they do advance directives. And one woman was saying she, on a Thanksgiving dinner, she sat everyone around the table and said, this is my turkey. This is my chance to talk to you about what I would like my advance directive to say. Then we'll have the pumpkin pie, right? This is my chance. And what was lovely about that is that everyone was at the table. The whole family was at the table. So you don't have that situation of, which doctors hate, understandably, because of fear of litigation, of some estranged family member. They talk about the black sheep riding in on the white horse, waving his or her hand and saying, Mom loved me best. I know what she really wanted. Because, frankly, if the hospital senses there's dissent within a family, the default is to provide care. That's what they'll do. So again, to have everyone in the room together so they can all hear you and they can raise questions then and talk about it. They can also recognize that someone's been appointed, and that's very important that one person be appointed. Again, the other thing doctors don't want is a whole team of people offering advice, right? They want one person to speak for you. Finally, just because it's important as well, there's a new document called a PULST that you've probably heard of. That's an acronym. It's Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. It's fairly new. Schwarzenegger signed it into law just several years ago. It's a state document. It's not for us, you know, folks who are healthy, you know, getting around, doing fine. It's typically for the very frail, the very elderly. But it's very specific, and what's wonderful about it is it's a medical order, right? So this is very different than an advance directive. It's a medical order that you do in your doctor's office. It's signed by your doctor, but it's very specific. And what it does is when you call 911, which is very human, important thing to do in a crisis, before they break down the door coming in with all their equipment to resuscitate you or offer ventilator, respirator, whatever, it tells them, do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this. And it's a binding medical document. It's as if the doctor were right there in the room with you. And they need to honor that legally. So just to be clear, advance directives are something everyone needs to have. You think about the cases that have been so divisive Terri Schiavo, you know, Karen Ann Quinlan, for those that have been around for a while. Those women were in their 20s, right? These were women in their 20s. So the communities that have been best at this, there's one out in Wisconsin, which is really the gold standard. It's called La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's the Gundersen Lutheran Healthcare System. They have community-wide, within this whole healthcare system, gotten something like 96% engagement of advanced directives. Essentially every single person in the community has an advanced directive. But these are living, people say, oh my gosh, I'm, 20 or 30. What do I know about what I want at the end of life? They're living documents. They can change. If you change your mind, tear it up, do a new one. It's really simple. Really, really simple. And they don't have to be this, as I mentioned, they can be really, I went to an attorney who probably would have billed about $1,500 for mine. I did it just as an exercise. You certainly can get them done by an attorney. They're pretty complicated. They don't need to be. You really want something that can be read very quickly and can help family members in a crisis. So just to reiterate, everyone needs an advance directive. If you're old and frail and, in your 90s and failing health, if you have progressive, chronic, severe health conditions, a pulsed or in a nursing facility, a pulsed makes a whole lot of sense. It's on bright pink piece of paper. You can tape it by your bed, tape it the refrigerator. Two different documents. To answer the question of do not resuscitate, DNRs are very well known. They're also very out of date. An advanced directive will deal with the issue of you can have it deal with the issue of cardiac pulmonary resuscitation. A pulsed absolutely addresses it. So a pulsed is a DNR plus a whole lot more. Thank you.
A number of people raised questions, as it was striking to Julissa in your remarks, that as good as it is to have the papers that you've referred to, DNRs, et cetera, they also often aren't enough.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could speak to that reality, and in particular in light of something like a patient advocate, someone serving in that role, and what you may have encountered in your reporting in that regard.
Mm-hmm. They're really important. They're not enough. The conversation's really important. When you get to the hospital, a patient advocate or a social worker that a lot of hospitals have now, a crisis, every hospital has a bioethics committee that you can use as well. The challenge I had, which I think probably everyone in this room has had, is getting the information you need to make the decisions. So what I was hearing a lot of was, we can try and turn this infection around. We can try and bring his blood pressure up. We can do surgery. We can do this. What I wasn't getting were all the physicians together in one room to answer my question, which was, where are we headed here? Where are we going? Let's say he survives this. What's it look like afterwards? That's something that hospital social workers and patient advocates, I think, can at least help get the conversation going. But you need to be aggressive or assertive. The doctors work for you, right? And you're absolutely entitled to this information. And it sometimes requires really speaking up and being really brave, because medicine operates in silos, and they may not even be talking to each other, the infectious disease people and the surgeons. And it's really important also, there's a wonderful group called the Coalition for Compassionate Care based in Sacramento, and they have a document that describes the kind of questions that you can ask doctors when you're in a crisis. Will the benefit surpass the harm? What is the harm? Let's say we do the fifth round of chemo, having failed the first four. What are our side effects look like? What are the chances of actually pulling through this? What will the quality of life be? Thank you.
So we have a question that speaks about a certain stigma attached to hospice care. And really, you spoke about what you've discovered to be the great value of it, but I'm wondering if you could speak to what you've encountered in terms of such a stigma. I mean, why don't people use it more? What is that stigma? How to address that?
One of the big challenges with hospice care is that once you enter into hospice, you need to surrender curative, rescue therapies. That's actually one of the reforms that I proposed in my final piece. There are some hospices now that are exploring the ability to do both. So a lot of people wait because we all want miracles, right? And we keep thinking there might be one more thing out there that we want to try. And we perceive hospice as giving up, right? But it's not. You know, there's always hope. You know, there may not be hope of a heroic, miraculous turnaround where you'll be, you know, back on the tennis courts in 2 weeks. But there could be a different kind of hope. There could be a hope of an ending that's free of pain. Could be a hope to die in your own home. These are good hopes. These are things that hospice can offer. And I think it is stigmatized, and it's totally inappropriate, because I think if it was less stigmatized, we'd be more willing to take advantage of it. There are people who graduate from hospice. You know, you can do that. To be eligible for hospice, you need to have a doctor say that you are expected to die within 6 months. Right? But there have actually been studies showing that people, this was an interesting study with lung cancer, who actually lived longer in hospice than they did in the hospital. Pretty crazy. I had a wonderful physician help me with my series based out at UCSF, who actually, his 85-year-old mother fell and hit her head. She was rushed into the hospital because they considered her unstable on her feet and they needed to do all these scans. They confined her to the bed, which meant she needed catheters, which meant she needed all this other stuff. She began to get bed sores, began to have agitation. She was really disoriented. She went from a woman who fell and hit her head to someone who actually was getting pretty sick for reasons that were incidental to the head injury. So the only way he felt like he could spring her from the hospital was to admit her to hospice, right? So she went into hospice and recovered. You know, when she was in hospice, she could have her own Korean food. She could have her own Bible translated into Korean. Everybody was there. She was feeling pretty good. And she's still alive. This was, what, 2 or 3 years ago.
I hope this isn't unfair to pose what is really a very particular story to you, but I think this story, to my mind, is representative of all the stories here in the room today listening to you. And so just want to pose a question that I think is representative of all those gathered here. I just watched my mother struggle for support from her siblings in caring for my grandparents. How do I start the conversation with my siblings without offending my mother, who's sensitive about turning 60, and without knowing what our resources will be as our careers progress? How would you speak and answer this person's question?
So it's a caregiving question or an advanced directive?
It's a question about how to start a conversation with one's siblings about your mother.
Right. I'd come at it from a place of love, that we're all in this together. We all adore Mom. Let's talk about how we can support her as best we can. Sometimes as you mentioned the question, mothers don't want to bring or fathers don't want to bring it up. It's really interesting. The kids don't want to bring it up because they don't want to be perceived as, you know, pushing Mom off the cliff, right? Mom doesn't want to bring it up because she doesn't want to be depressing. So everyone's kind of waiting for everyone else to bring it up. Starting with siblings, I didn't have the benefit of having siblings. I understand it can either be wonderful or not, depending. But what a great place to start talking with each other, because there may be, you can identify really early on who has certain strengths within the siblings. There may be a sibling, I talked to a woman whose brother had gone through West Point, and he was who she wanted to be in charge when push came to shove. She didn't want her husband, who would never admit to losing her. She didn't want her kids because they were drama queens. But it's a really good, maybe you have someone in the family who's a really good executor, someone who could take, and sort of describe in advance how to divvy up responsibilities. And then I think it's really important to go to the parent and say, help us out here, Mom. We love you so much that we want to do the best job we can in taking care of you. Should the day ever come when you become frail or disabled or have an emergency and get rushed to the hospital. And I've noticed that people respond to that because they want to help. And if you can say, you're helping us by making this less stressful and letting us plan better, and it's just going to be good all the way around.
Well, this topic, obviously, Lisa, has so many ethical questions attached to it. One we haven't touched on yet is really this question of intergenerational justice, to put it in a sort of a bit of a mouthful of a phrase. But this questioner asks, in a sense, are we spending so much on care for the elderly that, as this questioner puts it, are the young being robbed by the dying?
Great question. They're probably better experts than I on this subject. I was horrified that Medicare was so willing to pay without challenge some of the expenses in my dad's care. This was a time when, you know, kids can't afford to go to community college, right? Rising fees at the UCs. Dad was very frugal. He would have been horrified. I think we're beginning to rethink allocation of resources, but I think it's really contingent on us to start this conversation. You know, whenever it starts at the top in Congress, gets labeled, you know, death panels, God forbid. As you all may know, the whole death panel discussion was simply about getting Medicare to pave to have advanced directive conversations in a doctor's office. Right now, it's really hard to for doctors to be paid to just talk, right? They're paid for surgery. They're paid for all kinds of interventions. They're not paid to just talk. And talking's where we make, there's a lot of wisdom in these conversations. So it's not built into the system. So I think we can begin by restructuring what, or challenging a bit what medicine pays for, what it doesn't. But I think a lot of the conversation needs to come from us because they're, I'll tell you, I've talked to folks in Washington, they're terrified. They're not going to be the ones to talk about, you know, depriving granny of end-of-life care. But it's an excellent point, and I think those of us who care about the next generation need to be the ones to start this conversation.
In your remarks, Lisa, you referred to the differential costs of similar sorts of treatment, even in hospitals in San Jose and certainly elsewhere. And I know we've seen news stories on that in the last weeks around this cost coming up. Could you speak more about that? Is it simply a function of different culture, different treatments? Is there something the American people ought to know more about in terms of where taxpayer dollars are going here in these wildly differential cost pictures?
Great question. I think all of this just cries out for greater transparency. That's the first big step of knowing what the charges are. You know, you just think about it. This is a system where neither the buyer nor the seller really knows what the cost is, right? The doctors don't know. The patients don't know. We don't find out till the bill comes in and what's it based on. So I really, you know, welcome the push for greater transparency. And then in terms of the, I don't know enough about it to know what's driving some of the differentials. Certainly culture in terms of overutilization within a certain facility is a big, big driver. There are hospital cultures where do everything is much more of a mantra. And then there are certain medical, certainly there's an interesting study looking at different medical schools that feed different hospitals. So there are some medical schools that are, they're much more restrained, and you see that influence the hospitals around them. But it's really tough. I mean, you don't go in into ER and say, save dad or not, how much will it cost? It's a really tough problem. But I think we can begin by you know, or you don't go into a doctor's office much as you would a used car lot and see prices posted on the door. So it's very hard to be an educated consumer. And I think, you know, the whole subject of rationing is so loaded that I think doctors, again, are very hesitant to deny care. If there's even the suggestion that they somehow think you're not worthy of it. Really interesting study showing how some minority groups actually use more end-of-life care and heroics at the end than whites, for instance. And really interesting questions to why that is. And perhaps one of the contributing factors is that historically they've been deprived of care, and they're very sensitive to the perception that the end-of-life, that they really don't deserve the best.
two very significant ethical issues and related ones, assisted suicide and euthanasia, are certainly sort of lurking in the background here of all this this information and conversation. Could you please address, like, whether you encountered those issues in terms of your reporting, and are we inclining ourselves more in those directions as a society now, or turning away from that? What did you find?
I'm divided on the issue. Certainly there seems to be an appetite for offering people choices at the end. It was tried here in California and was defeated for reasons I won't get into here. There seems to be a growing national movement. Certainly there are several states that are moving that way. Oregon, of course, Washington, my understanding is Montana, maybe Montana as well, and Vermont. Thank you, Vermont, just with today. I've also heard physicians say that if we can provide real quality care at the end, it takes it a little bit off the table. That if you have adequate pain control, if you have treatment for depression, the issue is not as compelling as we might imagine. I wish I knew more. I think it's something that definitely deserves further explanation. I'm hesitant to rush to that as a solution, though, before we start fixing some of these other problems.
We had a question about kind of balancing mental and physical health, and wondering in some ways if you might address, do we need to pay more attention perhaps in terms of working with the elderly to mental health issues, to prepare for the physical health issues that arise, or how do you see these things being balanced in terms of these end-of-life issues?
I think mental health is really underappreciated in elders. I think absolutely engaging them more. And so there's some really great pioneering efforts of young people working with elders. I think depression is a major contributor to physical problems as well. I think it's tough to diagnose depression sometimes in the elderly. But something else I experienced, particularly in talking to some of my dad's friends at the end, is that the elderly are pretty smart about all of this. In a lot of ways, they've thought about it a lot more than we have. And a lot of times, they're less willing to grab on to every remote hope than the family is. You know, often it's the family saying, do everything. We just can't let her go. And there's a lot of wisdom in elders that, again, I think is underappreciated, and I'd like to make them part of this, a greater part of this conversation as well.
Well, we've talked a lot about death, so I guess it's now time to talk about pain, one of the other topics here today. And I'm wondering if you might address that, because I think that seems like it's such an important part of this whole picture as well. And what are people's attitudes toward pain? What did you encounter in your work, and how might we address that better in our care and in our working with our family and friends?
Pain control is huge. It's central. I think we're getting a lot better about it. Probably a decade or two ago, there was a lot of fear of addiction to painkillers, which is crazy when you think about it. At the end of life, that addiction is really should not be a concern. So certainly morphine and its equivalents are a lot more available than they used to do. They can do a wonderful, wonderful job. They're also wonderful medications for anxiety control at the end, which I think we should use more of. All that being said, I really needed to stay on top of it with my dad's pain control. I had essentially moved into his hospital room and was living there, and I could tell by watching him if there was any discomfort or any grimace, and I was the one who would go out and say, we need to increase the dose, because it's very calibrated, and you need an advocate. You need someone who's actually watching. A person can't express themselves, right? So there are a lot of nonverbal cues as to how much discomfort someone is in, and that's the benefit of being there as a family member and having an advocate. But you need to push a little bit. So I needed, you know, because it was all worked out formulaically that he'd have, you know, 0.5 whatever morphine, and I'd have to go to them and say, no, actually, we need to increase this. A little bit of resistance, but you know, you can push. I think the best doctors, and certainly palliative care, is doing a tremendous job of underscoring the importance of pain control. When you're not feeling pain, your anxiety drops, your fear drops. I think, you know, a lot of us, we're not afraid of dying, right? We're just afraid of suffering, right? So if you can take suffering off the table, that really changes the whole experience profoundly.
You've mentioned, often speaking of doctors with whom you worked, nurses and all of that, and there's a question here, and I'd like to slightly modify it, but I'm wondering, in your experience of working with the clinical staff at hospitals and all, what is your sense of their education for dealing with these end-of-life issues? Do you think it's adequate or not, or do things need to be addressed in terms of that education?
Things absolutely need to be addressed. Hospitals are there to fix us, right, to heal us and send us back out into the world. They're pretty lousy places to die. We ended up on the med-surg unit when my dad was dying, surrounded by families going through appendix surgery, grandchildren, balloons, the whole thing. The other palliative care is trying to address this. I've been told there are only 200 new palliative care physicians graduating for specialized training every single year. And as we age, the demand will be in the thousands and thousands and thousands. And these are the folks who can offer the pain control and the symptom relief. There are also some new interesting experiments going on in some hospitals. I know down at USC and then Emory in Atlanta, where they're actually putting a palliative care person in the emergency room. So when you come into the emergency room, yes, you have the option of heroic, do everything. You also have the option of talking to a physician who can say, let's talk about what the other choices are, because there's a whole lot we can do, and not all of it requires heroics. I didn't have the benefit of having that person in the ER when we arrived, and I would have really welcomed it, because you don't know, right? All you care about when you're with an elderly person in emergency room is to make them okay so they don't suffer. And educating doctors about end of life, also educating doctors that dying isn't a failure on their part, right? Doctors, I think, are really reluctant to admit that they lost someone. But that's kind of what happens, right, at the end of life. And I think they're getting better at that, but I think there's a whole lot more that needs to be done.
I wonder if we might broaden that too, that speaking of the medical staff, what was your sense of, say, the pastoral staff,
right,
social work staff in hospitals, nursing homes and all? Were they prepared to deal with these issues sufficiently?
Great question. Absolutely. I could never sufficiently thank the chaplains and the nurses. They're the ones that actually know what's going on. You know, they were the ones that when the doctors left the room, I could turn to the nurse and say, tell me what's really happening here. Or say, and this would be, you know, 2 a.m. when you're together in the darkness, sleepless, saying, if this was your dad or your mom, what would you do? Or say, you've seen hundreds of these folks. I haven't. Help me out here. What's going on? Chaplains were fabulous. I used probably every chaplain on the service. Didn't matter if they were Jewish, Catholic, Episcopalian. You know, doesn't really matter. You just want someone there in the room to say, let's pray. You're looking really tired. I think you're really worried. And this whole thing of fearing death, and if you are a spiritual person and you really believe that maybe there is something else beyond this planet, then what's so scary about it? And being able to talk to them about that, that if you really do believe in a higher power, and he's suffering, and he's old, and he's been a man of faith or a woman of faith all her life, maybe it's okay to hand this over to some higher power. And their being there in the room with me gave me the courage to do that. It was huge. And they just hang out with you. It's pretty wonderful. Pretty wonderful.
Well, Lisa, we have a practical but very important question here, and which is, where can one find a compendium of your articles written on this very topic, the cost of dying? So people will want to see that.
Thank you. I'm so flattered by the interest. It's won a couple awards, which has given me the chance to proselytize a little bit around the country to other journalists about how this is important. To find our piece, we have an app, which I know is more popular in some demographics than others. So I mentioned apps to geriatric populations. They think it's like a new hemorrhoid medication or something. But it's wonderful. It's very interactive and engaging. So if you, it's Cost of Dying at BarryNewsGroup.com. If you Google that, there's an app. You can find it. We also reprinted a special section 2 weeks ago, which we have copies of at the Mercury News. If you email me, I'm happy to send you a copy. We have one here in the audience. Thank you. And there's also a wonderful website. It's CostofDying.com. Again, if you Google it for Krieger. All of my articles live on that website, but what's wonderful about it is it's given us the ability to add other resources there, so we're able to link to the Coalition for Compassionate Care, some other places where you can get advanced directives. There's a group called Five Wishes that has advanced, so you can click on those links and the advanced directives will come up. It's also wonderful because the website has excerpted emails of some of the people I've heard from with photos that we're using with their permission. It has a lot of great Facebook dialogue, which what's so wonderful about this is that it's engaging the community, right? And that's how change happens. It's engaging the entire community, and I feel like we're all coming out of this a lot smarter and a lot better than we were before. My email is it's L. Krieger, like the name, just all one word, LKRIEGER at mercurynews.com. I'm happy to send you links to recommended advanced directives. Thank you for your interest. Really appreciate it.
Actually, one last question, if I may, at least before we close our session out, and that is maybe switching a little more to journalism. I mean, often we see news stories by great newspapers and reporters like yourself. We don't often see them about something so close and deeply personal to them. Right. I wonder if you might comment on how it was as a reporter to work on a story like this about someone so dear to you.
Yeah. Initially, it was really difficult because I felt very exposed, but it was also driving me crazy. You know, after I lost my dad, I just went over and over and over in my mind, did I do the right thing? Should I have tried this? Should we have quit earlier? Should we have been more aggressive? That stuff can eat you alive. You know, it's just, it haunts you. So after several months of it just ruminating in my own mind and having sleeplessness and all of those issues, I thought, well, let's just review the decisions I made. So that's when I asked for his medical record, which are actually pretty illuminating documents. You're totally entitled to them. They're yours. You paid for them. So I got the medical record and went through every decision day by day. And I thought, wow, you know, I really did make the right call on some of these. But how crazy is this that this is how it ended up? How much did it cost? Because at that point, I hadn't gotten a single bill from anyone. And so I asked for the bill, itemized bill. It was probably 12 pages long. And then I was able to correlate the clinical experience with the financial experience. And that's how we arrived at the title, The Cost of Dying, because I was able to see the tally accumulate as minute by minute by minute by minute. And then look, of course, look at the final cost to society, because you know we ended up paying, what, probably $8,000 out of pocket. You know, society paid for the rest, Medicare paid for the rest, and then of course there's the much higher cost, which is personal, right? What it does to your family, how it's taken me a while to start remembering my dad, who was not the dad in crisis, but the dad who was such a joy for 87 years of his life. So once I did all that, I had a free weekend and a couple free days at work, and I went to my editors and said, you know, what do you think? Let me just write about how this felt to me, and really generous. I've got some wonderful editors. They said, go for it, and because I think they knew that even if I put it into words, that it would help me just be a better writer, a better employee. I'd be happier at work. And did that, turned it in, and they said, let's go for it. Let's publish it. And then it was, and this is why I love community journalism, it was the response of the community to them, to us, that told us we really had struck something big here. There's really a lot more than we know about this issue, because we heard from so many readers whose crises dwarfed mine. I mean, horror stories. I've heard from doctors who had horror stories. You know, doctors up at Highland Hospital who said, here, we've had a woman on who's essentially brain dead for 2 or 3 months, and the family can't reach agreement about when it's time to let her go. So that really gave us the momentum to explore this more deeply, and with each piece we did, we just felt stronger and stronger about the mission. And they've also given me a lot of free time to talk to people about it, which is taking the message further, and then nationally being able to talk to other journalists about the message, so that other journalists can take their own experiences and experiences in their community and write about them as well. There's a huge hunger to read about this. And when we started this conversation about saying how death is scary, right, something we don't want to talk about, I think the media plays a huge role in desensitizing us to that. Like, get over it. You know, we write about everything else. Let's write about this. And let's make it okay and make it better for all of us at the end.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. I hope you all enjoyed this afternoon's program hosted by the Markless Center for Applied Ethics and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Lisa Krieger, science and medical research reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, our audience here at Santa Clara University, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.